Do you think that nationalism is good or bad, Lord Russell?
One will have to distinguish between cultural and political aspects of nationalism. From the cultural point of view, one of the rather sad things about the modern world is its extraordinary uniformity. If you go to an expensive hotel, there's nothing whatever to show you which continent it's in or which part of the world or anything. They're all exactly alike over the whole world, and that gets a little dull, and it makes rich travelling really hardly worth doing. If you want to see foreign countries, you have to travel poor. And in that respect, I think there's a great deal to be said for nationalism, for keeping diversity in literature, in art, in language, and all kinds of cultural things. But when it comes to politics, I think that nationalism is unmitigatedly evil. I don't think there's a single thing to be said in its favor.
What are the purposes of the organization of the national state?
Well, the main purposes are what the state itself calls defense and what all other states call aggression. It's the same phenomenon, only it has different names from the two sides. And in fact, the state is primarily an organization for killing foreigners. That's its main purpose. There are, of course, other things they do. They do a certain amount of educating. But in the course of educating, you try very hard to make the young think it's a grand thing to kill foreigners. I mean, take, for instance, that verse in the national anthem, which they don't sing as often as they did when I was young, where it says, confound their knavish tricks, frustrate their politics, and make them fall. And we all used to sing that with great gusto about every foreigner.
Like Rule Britannia.
Well, Rule Britannia also now, since Britannia ceased to rule the waves, and we can't very well say, rule the United States rule the waves, because it won't scan.
Is that the sort of thing that you mean by nationalism being harmful?
What I mean by it being harmful is that it's a part of its teaching to inculcate the view that your own country is glorious and has always been right in everything, whereas other countries, well, no. One thinks, as Mr. Podsnap says in Dickens, foreign nations, I am sorry to say, do as they do. And I don't think that it's right to view foreign nations in that way. One sees curious examples of it. I wrote a book in which I was talking about nationalism, and I said there is, of course, one nation which has all these supreme virtues that every nation arrogates to itself. That one nation is the one to which my reader belongs. And I got a letter from a Pole saying, I'm so glad you recognize the superiority of Poland.
Yes, I see. Well, what sort of other occasions do you think it arises?
There was a very charming young lady at a meeting of the United Nations who was much given to riding a bicycle. She came from Ecuador, and her bicycle ran away with her down a very steep hill, and she might easily have been killed. And my friend Gilbert Murray asked her, were you not frightened when your bicycle ran away with you? And she said, oh, no. I said to myself, remember that you are an Ecuadorian.
This, of course, could apply to anybody.
Yes. I used to tell this story sometime, and everybody laughed. And I would say, yes, but you know, if I'd mentioned a certain other country, none of you would have laughed.
Why do people want to be divided up into national states?
Well, it's part of our emotional apparatus that we are liable to both love and hate, and we like to exercise them. So we love our compatriots and we hate the foreigners. Of course, we love our compatriots only when we're thinking of foreigners. When we've forgotten foreigners, we don't love them so much.
But if you're saying a certain amount of nationalism is a good and agreeable thing, how are you going to see that it doesn't get out of hand?
Well, I don't think you can. You can never make sure of these things. But what you can say, and what the world will have to say if man is to survive, is that armies and navies and air forces should not be national, but international. And then it won't much matter if you think ill of some other country, provided you're not in a position to kill them off.
But if you are going to have rivalry and competition to stimulate, isn't it convenient to do it on a national basis?
Yes, I don't mind at all having competition and emulation, provided it doesn't involve killing. I think that municipal rivalry, if one city builds a very fine town hall, the other thinks we must have a fine town hall, well, all that's all to the good. But Manchester and Liverpool, I understand, don't love each other, but they haven't got private armies to go to war with each other.
But how are you going to run an orderly society?
If one's talking now of what ought to be the case, there ought to be only one armed force, which should be international and not national. And in that case, these situations of danger that you're talking of wouldn't arise, because there would be no opportunity for national aggression, and therefore no need for national defence.
But they do arise at the moment.
They do arise at the moment. And there you've got to get into people's heads that while it's quite proper to resist aggression, it is not proper to commit aggression. And if nobody committed aggression, the occasions for resisting aggression would not arise. But I do think that resisting aggression is quite a proper thing to do.
Take the Middle East since the end of the war. There, Arab nationalism has thrown up new states and given a lot of Arabs a kind of sense of competence and well-being they didn't have before. Now, is that bad?
Well, it's very difficult as yet to say. I think insofar as it involves raising the self-respect of Arabs and making Arabs think that they're capable of great achievements, in all that, it's good. But insofar as it involves hatred of people who are not Arabs, for example, of Israel, it can't be considered good.
What I don't understand is this. How, once national feelings have been aroused in worthy causes, do you prevent them from slopping over into bad ones?
Simply through unifying the governments. Now, take the case of England and Scotland. England and Scotland went to war with each other for centuries. For centuries. And it was universally held on each side of the border that it was proper to hate the people on the other side of the border. And then from a pure dynastic accident, the governments were unified.
How far would you say that racial prejudice is connected with nationalism?
It comes in if there is a racial difference between two neighboring nations. Racial prejudice comes in and intensifies the nationalism of each. It's not the same thing. Racial prejudice is not the same thing as nationalism, but it very easily gets allied with it.
Would you say that racial prejudice has very much increased over the last 50 years?
I suppose it has, but I'm not quite sure. I don't know. I mean, take, for instance, Rudyard Kipling, who did a great deal to stimulate British imperialism. He talked about the lesser breeds without the law, and all his writings were concerned to suggest that anybody who wasn't white, or almost one might say anybody who wasn't British, was somewhat inferior. So that I don't think it's so recent as all that.
We know that Europeans are racially prejudiced, but do you think that Africans and Asians are any less prejudiced racially?
Not a bit less. And in fact, because it's rather new with them, they probably suffer more at the present time. I should think that both African and Asian nationalisms are at the moment more fierce than any that exist among Europeans, because they've just awakened to it. Nationalism is, apart from the East-West tension and the danger of an East-West war, I think nationalism is the greatest danger that man is faced with at the present time.
Do you think that people sometimes assume that when other nations or groups are being treated badly, then those nations, because they're being oppressed, have got all the virtues?
Oh, certainly they do. It's a fixed pattern that when some nation or class or whatnot is unjustly oppressed, people with decent humanitarian feelings begin to think they must be perfectly virtuous and altogether delightful people. And then, of course, in the end, they get free. And as soon as they get free, they devote themselves, as far as their power goes, to practicing all the vices that previously were practiced by their oppressors.
Is this an inevitable pattern?
No, it's not inevitable. And it doesn't always happen. I think one must take India as a case of how it doesn't always happen. I think India, since it became free, has been singularly without that sort of vice that so often happens to liberated peoples.
Why do you think it is that nationalism seems so much more virulent today than it ever has been before?
Oh, it's due to education. Education has done an awful lot of harm. I sometimes think it would have been better if people were still unable to read and write in the great majority. Because as they are able to read and write, they become open to propaganda. And in each country, the propaganda is controlled by the state, and it's what the state likes. And what the state likes is to have you quite ready to commit murder when you're told to.
Do you think there's any other solution to the problem of nationalism than having an imminent invasion from Mars?
Well, that, of course, would stop it at once. We should then have planetary nationalism for our planet is against all other planets, and we should teach in schools how much more noble our planet had always been than these wretched Martians, whom we shouldn't know anything, and therefore we could invent any number of vices. So that would be a very simple solution, but I'm afraid we may not have to do it, we may not be able to do it that way. And I think we've got to hope that people will get positive aims of promoting the welfare of their own and other countries, rather than these negative aims of strife.
Thank you, Lord Russell. I'm looking forward to our next talk.